Welcome to Entrepreneurs the Playbook. I'm David Meltzer here at the greatest stadium ever built. It's amazing what $5.5 billion will buy you. That's not a green screen. That is actually a billion-dollar screen. $1 billion has an elevator. You can go up and down. I've been blessed to be in it. Speaking of blessed, here at SoFi Stadium, we are blessed to have a true entrepreneur, ran over a $500 million company himself, CEO, founder of Aptiv. His name, David Royce. Welcome to the Playbook.
Thanks. Appreciate the opportunity.
I love having extraordinary entrepreneurs, meaning guys who have gotten into the half billion, the billion range, because the air gets very thin when you're making that kind of money, whether it's for the company or for yourself. Hopefully, they're somehow equilibrated together. Sometimes I meet guys who are companies make a lot and they didn't make shit. I feel bad for them. But I'm sure your journey was like mine. Things happened very slowly. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, I'll take you back to college. Did you have any idea that you would be an entrepreneur who was running over a $500 million company?
No, it was the last thing on my mind.
What was on your mind?
I'm a broke college student. How do I make money?
You want to make money? Me too. And how did you think you were going to make it?
So I was studying finance. I thought I was going to go into investment banking and
good way to make money.
To New York. Yeah.
And what inspired you at that time? Was it just the money to be an investment banker, or was there something else about it?
So I had seen, my father actually talked about it a lot. In fact, he had worked as CEO of Motel 6, and they sold that off to a private equity group. And they came in, and in 6 months, my dad was out. And so I learned the lesson that in terms of the totem pole, he was a hired, executive. The private equity guys, like, they had the power. And the investment bankers. So I thought, it'd be kind of nice to be at the top of the food chain. We struggled actually for about 7 years there after that. And it made me taste, I want to have money someday. I don't want to be in the same financial situation.
And you saw the temporary status of being a CEO and making money, that it doesn't and isn't promised to last forever.
Especially because he didn't have equity in the business. Right. It's like he could be hired.
He's a hired gun at the highest level, and yet gave you an idea about equity and what we can do when we own equity. Now, when you founded Aptiv, you had immediate success, I imagine.
We did with Aptiv, and I had four companies over 20 years.
So you're an overnight success.
Yeah, over 20 years. It's in each one, it was just a way to be able to build. We'd have success, and then we go, okay, we need money. How are we going to do that? It's either we go get investors, or we had this unique ability to be able to sell off the accounts with the corresponding technicians and keep the golden goose, which was the sales force, the executive team, a key operator in each location. And so I was able to keep control. Again, going back to that lesson, wanted to maintain control and the equity and just keep growing and going.
When I read a lot of books, or listen to them now, thank God for audio. You can do it stretching and balance while you're listening to books compared to reading. But Collins wrote one of my favorite books, Good to Great, that a lot of people will tell you that people are your assets, but he disagrees with the 11 companies that he examined that were these level five good to great companies. Right. He says that it's the right people. And it sounded like you are always keeping the right people, but he doesn't explain in the book how we determine who the right people is. I believe we determine it by their values and practices. That'll determine who the right person is, and it's our job to put the right person in the right place to utilize it. For you, what's your methodology? Because you seem to have followed that system or belief as well.
Yeah, so I read another book. I love Collins. It's one of my favorites. I read another book by Tony Hsieh. Delivering happiness.
Yeah,
it's all about creating core values. And his story is he had LinkedIn Exchange initially. It grew so fast, they were just hiring anybody to keep up with the growth.
Pulses.
And he just said, I didn't even want to go to work anymore because I didn't really understand everybody else. We weren't part of the same. We didn't feel aligned in what we enjoyed doing and the direction of the company. So he sold it, got out of it. And then when he started Zappos, he said, I'm going to set core values. We're going to hire specifically to these core values. And that's it. And anybody, if they come on and they're the wrong fit, we're actually going to usher them off the bus like Collins did.
Yeah, right.
Right. And so we were really focused on that. And honestly, that book saved me hundreds of thousands of dollars from going to MBA school.
Yeah, me too.
I thought I was going to have to go there to try to figure out how do you maintain that same family feel we had at the first location across, you know, dozens or hundreds of locations.
And as you know, I lost over $100 million, went bankrupt back in 2008. Lots of lessons, protection, promotion. I say love and perfection of Dave Meltzer occurred then. Have you ever faced bankruptcy or any time?
First year in business, almost bankrupt the business. Yeah, so I thought we were going to, that we'd do well. I had no idea we were going to do as well as we did. And the problem is we only had so much cash. And if you grow too fast, you can grow out of your money and actually bankrupt yourself. So the way we paid our sales commissions was, you know, we were paying the commissions out before the revenue came in because we anticipated our customers would be with us for 5 years. And it was a cash flow issue. So it was a good problem. I was able to go back because we were so successful. I was able to go back to my key sales managers and people and say, hey, can I pay you out in another month or two? I'll pay you interest at 10%, but I've got to do this or like... there's no other way to do it.
Or you won't get paid anyway.
Yeah, and they were totally cool with it. I worked with them. They were super excited about the company, and it worked itself out. But I was, from that point forward, every week I'm checking my finances to make sure. You want to learn that lesson early.
Yeah, and in the process of finding the right people, hiring is one of the biggest nemesis, as you're talking about with Tony and other people that we've studied. Are there things that you look for when you're hiring? And if so, what are your favorite interview questions or questions to ask to find out whether, for me, for example, is gratitude, forgiveness, accountability, and inspiration? I want people, they need to prove they have a desire that they must be what they can be. And then I look at the skills and I say, okay, is this a teachable or unteachable skill? And if it's unteachable, I won't hire them if they don't have it. If they don't have the skill, but it's teachable and they're grateful, forgiving, accountable, they have a desire that they must be what they can be, I'll hire them right away. For you, what are you looking for? And is there, you know, one quick question that you can tip us off on when you're interviewing someone?
If you were an animal, what type of animal would you be?
Very Jim Quick-like.
I'm totally kidding. Part of it's I want to know that they have a sense of humor. not really. You know, I think I tend to look at people like books. And if you look at their track record, you look at their resume and what they've achieved over time, are they leaving each job? Do they leave a job every 6 months and go to the next one? To me, that's what's most important is do they have a track record that makes sense? If they're at a job every year and they go to the next one every year, that's probably the longevity I'm going to get out of that individual. You know, I really like 2 to 3 years in something. It shows that they're willing to stick it out, learn from that position. They've got some loyalty and will move on. And yeah, you're always trying to find people, right, who are excited about learning and growing and evolving, or that have that optionality to grow.
Yeah, and it's changed. You've been in business a long time like myself, so it used to be, you know, will they stay with me 10, 20 years? Now we're like, 2 or 3 years, cool. You know, we can get a lot out of them. One of the more difficult things, too, is firing. And, you know, I hire very slowly. I have a very certain process. I know what I'm looking for. I have a difficult time firing fast. In fact, I coach people and they're like, oh, I should have known. I should have listened to you. But I have to be honest. It's one of those areas that I've never met any entrepreneur executive that I've coached, been with, sat on a board of that ever fired when they thought they should have fired.
It's true.
Like, because we're human. What philosophies do you have around firing people from your companies?
I think it's really easy. You know, everybody says, you know, go for A players. You know, C players will drain you. Exit them off the bus as quickly as you can. I actually think it's the B players that are the hard ones, where they're good enough, but they're not quite bad enough. You know, to fire and let go. But the thing that scares away the A players is clearly C players, but it can also be some of the B players. Mm. And I think it's how affecting, you know, how much is it affecting your team? What type of position is it? Like, what type of department? And how much do they need that person to be an A player so the whole team can work together and there's synergy? There certainly are some positions that probably okay to have some B players in there. You know, sure. You don't want too many chiefs.
It's just so interesting and for me, fascinating, in fact, to see how successful executives and entrepreneurs look at that. One of the other things I've learned in my career, which I wasn't quite as clear about, is I actually have a emotional expense column. So I had one of my executives for a long time.
Yeah.
Was just a person that was difficult to get along with, not just me,
yeah,
but the other employees. You know, in fact, you know, later on, we kind of invite people to our holiday party, and we took a vote from, you know, the executives. Hey, should we invite this ex-executive? Because he was with the company for so long. Everybody invited no, right? They all voted no, because that's how much, like, he drained everyone. But he was probably my most profitable employee. And until I started examining the emotional expense, I started to realize he actually wasn't profitable at all, because he quantitatively diminished what we were doing revenue-wise by being so disruptive, by being emotionally expensive. Have you ever utilized emotional expense in any areas of your business, clients, employees, yeah, vendors?
Absolutely. Yeah, I had a top salesperson, top 1%, I let go because he was poison to the rest of the group. Sometimes you get salespeople, it's kind of like the tortoise and the hare. You know, their hares, they don't want to work as much. And they're like, oh, well, I'm better than everybody else because I can sell X amount in this, you know, amount of time. But it's like, but you're not better, because this individual, maybe they don't sell as much per day or per week, but over the course of the month, they will sell more than you because you're not willing to work hard. And then on top of that, you want to tell everybody else constantly, and you're bringing the team down. You're not uplifting. And so the people are pretty shocked they did that.
Yeah. Especially in the sales side, where they're even more isolated, and we almost expect that. But that's a brave move, and it turned out well, I assume.
Yeah, it was the right thing to do.
Right thing to do. Me too, by the way. My grandfather told me you need three things to be happy in life. He said you need to find the right partner, intimate partner, he said. He said she'll or he'll be the liaison to everything around you. And the better you are at choosing that liaison, the more happy you'll be. You spend a third of your life with family, friends, relatives. And if you don't have the intimate partner, it'll be a challenge if it's not the right one that isn't there for you and through you. He said, find the best bed that you can find. He said, a third of your life sleeping. If you don't spend he's actually from Russia. So he said, from Ukraine, he said, a third of your life sleeping and shtupping. So if you don't have a good bed, you're not gonna be happy. And I got the 8 sleep bed, by the way. And now the Wave Watch, definitely helping my sleep. Then, and a sleep coach for 18 years. But the last one, I didn't agree with him. He said, you need to find a job that you love to do. And I had trouble with that because it just wasn't true at a young age. Like, it's a very unrealistic thing to throw onto a 22-year-old or 24-year-old that's graduating from undergrad or grad school. You need to learn, you need to love what you do. And you're like, fuck, man, I'm just trying to get a job. I got law loans, or like, there's a reality, right? And for me, I started to have a different philosophy. I'd love, before I comment on it, for you to share, do you believe, you know, you have to love what you do and be passionate about what you do? You spend a third of your life in activity you get paid for. Do you feel you have to love that?
I actually don't. In fact, I'm a contrarian on this point. I think that passion, like trying to follow your passions, can be dangerous. Like, think of all the jobs that people they'd love to be a celebrity, right? Or like, they want to be in Hollywood, they want to be a musician, maybe they want to own a restaurant. But a lot of those industries, you've got to be the top 1% of 1% to make money at. It's hard. And so if you want to make money, you might think about industries everybody else is not looking at. In fact, when I there was an article called The Stealthy Wealthy recently in the Wall Street Journal, and it said that the top 0.1%, not just the top 1%, top 0.1%, you make $2.3 million or more. 43% of those individuals work in boring blue-collar jobs. But most of us here probably never even thought of that, right? It's not the first thing, because in the media, what's popular is things that are disrupting the world. You know, rocket ships and all that sort of stuff. So, I was not passionate about pest control. It was the last thing I would ever think I'd get into. But as I got into it, I became good at it. I was horrible at sales when I started. I sold zero the first week. Everybody else was selling 1 to 4 accounts around me. And by the end of the summer, I went out and got a bunch of sales books, trained 90 minutes every day. By the end of the summer, I was the top rookie. In 4 years, I was the top in the entire industry. If you're good at something, you typically like it. It feels good. And so even though pest control wasn't my passion, I turned it into my passion by getting really good at sales and then sales management and then recruiting and then ultimately becoming an entrepreneur and scaling a business.
You know, David, my intro video to my speaking is, do you think I loved legal research, you know, as I got out of law school and being a behavioralist and understanding the impact of our behaviors and alignment of behaviors with where we want to be or better.
Yeah.
There's a nuance because I believe that the passion that my grandfather meant to say is, I want to teach you how to learn to love what you don't like or love about what you love. So if you love making money, you need to learn to love what you don't like or love about making money. Because I love to make money for the sake of helping other people and having fun. Not I'll be happy when I make a lot of money, which is my first pursuit, but learning this passion about learning to love. And luckily for me, I was this, you know, underachieving, below average college football player, but I loved football. And it was the first time it became apparent that I learned to love what I didn't like or love about playing college football. But I loved football. And I think when you describe that, the other thing that comes to mind for my next question is, in this facade of happiness, people forget they're living a human experience, not an infinite one. They're within the context of an infinite experience, they're in a human experience. Time the heart starts, still stops. And so therefore, they forget to regulate these dreams. So I believe we can't do anything you want to do in the human experience in this lifetime. No matter how hard I practiced, I could never be an NBA All-Star. I know what it takes to be an NBA All-Star because I know where my skills and knowledge are, and that basement is too low that even with the extreme deltas that I achieve in my life, my delta would be below like a high school player probably, not even close to the same league as LeBron James' basement. And so my point is, we need to make sure that we're realistic about our skills and our knowledge and align it with what we do best, like you sales, me sales, and move that into, and yes, it's enjoyable to be good at something. That's why people keep doing it. How do you, for yourself, believe in the skills and knowledge, or are you a firm believer and you can do and be whatever you want to be?
Yeah, so basketball, we talked about that. Unless I'm close to 7 feet, I'm probably not going to do that well. I'm 6'4". Maybe I could have, you know, done basketball, but I think of getting
that in. That really hurts my feelings. I'm 5'7". Sorry, Ike. We're in the same boat.
I'll give you guys an example. I think that'll make sense. So one, if I have never played basketball before and I say, you know what, I'm going to challenge LeBron James to a game of one-on-one. And I think, I'm going to beat him. I'm going to take all of my life savings. I'm going to put it in on this game, all in. None of you would probably take that bet, right? That would be
insanity. I bet on LeBron.
Insanity. LeBron, yeah, he'd happily take that bet. But that's how I feel about just trying to go out and start a business from scratch in an industry that you've never been in before. It almost feels reckless in those terms. And so what I tell people is, one, learn how to identify an opportunity in business. Like, what are the best businesses out there? Like, get on ChatGPT. You can ask it almost any question. It'll tell you what the margins are in that business, what the likelihood often is of success. And then go try it out. Go get some experience. Go work in that industry for 6 months or a year and build a competitive advantage. For me, my advantage was sales initially. And then I realized I'd work at a big company the first year, a startup the next 3 years. I had a finance degree, which almost nobody had in my industry. And then I had a boss who was willing to even invest in me and say, you know what, I'll match what you're putting in if you'll give me a little bit of money. I want to be a silent partner, but call me if you have a question. So I mitigated all of my risk by doing those things. And I think if people would do that, they'd be much more successful. Similar to franchises, right? Franchises, 80% of them are successful. Why? They give you a blueprint. They tell you what best practices are, what the finances should look like, what are the KPIs to measure. But if the average business that starts up in 5 years, I think they're out of business, or 80% of them are out of business. So the statistical odds of success absolutely flip the other way when you're not in a franchise. So just proves my point in experience and how valuable it is.
Absolutely. Great example. Just to finish up, I believe in mentorship. I have at least three mentors all the time. I have a sleep mentor, as I suggested, for the subject matter, topics, and expertise. I believe the fastest way to get there is to find someone that's already there and ask them direction, and then help other people get to where they want to be. Is there a certain entrepreneur that you would love to mentor you, either historically, doesn't have to be alive, or one currently today? If you could pick one entrepreneur to mentor you, who would that be?
Yeah, for me, it would be...
Can't be Dave Meltzer. We don't accept kiss ads that don't work.
He stole the words right out of my mouth. You know, for me, it'd be Richard Branson.
Right on. Why?
Two things. So one, he ultimately created 8 separate individual businesses that did over $1 billion. And the statistical odds of that are, there's something to it, right? To be able to be that successful in that many different industries. And then two, the thing I really admire about him is he knows how to live and enjoy his money. And I have a lot of friends where they've built companies and they may have $100 million, $1 billion or whatever, and they're still so focused on the business that they don't have time, like, for their families, for their partner, or for themselves. Like, they can't go take a vacation. And for many years, I was like that too. I'd take a vacation, but I'd wake up at 5 a.m. and I'd work till 9 or 10 until my kids woke up and we could go do something together. And it was just like ingrained in me. And I wasn't like enjoying the fruits of my labors. So I really admire Richard for the lifestyle that he lives on top of all the money he's made and how much he actually gives back and mentors other entrepreneurs.
One of my favorites. Unfortunately, when I got to meet him, I was speaking at the UN after him. And I was on the phone and I had a marital emergency about my 5-year-old. So I'm in the green room on the telephone. It wasn't a cell phone, on a hardwired telephone. And in that, you know, marital emergency. So they're like, holy shit, Dave, you're on. So I went running out of the green room, and Richard is not a big dude and he's very trim. Yeah. And I literally met Richard Branson by running straight into him and knocking him onto his back. And so I was literally lying on top of him and I was like, oh shit, I'm so sorry. And then I kind of look up and get up. I'm like, oh fuck, Richard Branson. And he goes, good luck, David. And I go, really good to meet you. I hope to talk to you afterwards. He goes, I hope so too, but let's sit down and talk next time. I'm like, sounds good. But what a great person. And I love the reasons why you admire him and would like to be mentored him. And you can be, by the way. So we'd love to make that introduction. If you haven't realized it already, he's the Rolls Royce of entrepreneurship. His name is David Royce. He's the founder and CEO of Aptiv. We are blessed to be here. I'm David Meltzer at the greatest stadium ever built with entrepreneurs, the playbook.